Welcome to our five-week introductory course in concentration. It's a new thing. It's a new kind of thing for me to do. I've done the intro to mindfulness class for many years now and have enjoyed that a lot. And now I felt it was time to offer something on concentration, partly because my overall sense, my general sense, it's generalization, doesn't apply to everyone, is that the Vipassana students in the West, some of them get very good at mindfulness, but often what they're lagging in is concentration. And concentration and mindfulness need to be our partners for the purposes of mindfulness. In order to really let the mindfulness practice go deep, it needs to be coupled together with a strong concentration. And whenever they're partnered, especially as equal partners, you can't have too much concentration. But you can have too little. And so by focusing on concentration, it hopefully will begin encouraging the cultivation of this very important factor. The idea in this intro class is hopefully, or not, I don't know, somewhat modest, in that I'm thinking of it kind of in parallel to the intro, the mindfulness class that I teach. So kind of at that level. Kind of real basic kind of level of information and instructions. And I'm not expecting any of you to have attained the fourth jhana by the second class or the third or by the end even. That's for the Concentration 102. We're doing Concentration 101 today. So, my hope is that by giving some of the basic ideas, basic elements of concentration, the teachings, the instructions around them, that it can help a lot in you appreciating both the value and the beauty and the joy of concentration, and also in doing that, letting that factor become stronger in your life for all the benefits you can get from it, and including the benefit of supporting your mindfulness practice. So that's the kind of very general idea of what I have in mind. As I said, I've never done this before. I've never taken a five-week introductory course in concentration before. So it's kind of an experiment to see how anyone would do something like this. I sat down with myself and, you know, tried to review all the different things that I might want to teach and came together with a number of different things that I thought were important. So bear with me as this kind of an experiment as you do this, and I hope it's an experiment which is very useful for all of you, otherwise I wouldn't do it, and also something then as useful enough that we'll want to keep doing it, maybe on a yearly basis, just like we do the regular intro to mindfulness. When I was practicing in Burma, I was practicing in the Vipassana Center. And every morning I would go to breakfast, and the monastery was, the meditation center was kind of like, looked like kind of a sprawling junior college campus built in the 1950s. That's what I thought of when I was there. And except there were no cars on it. They're just, you know, these big large walkways. And every morning I'd walk to the dining room for the monks and the Western men. And I had to walk by. Often we went by in a single file, the monks first and then the Westerners would follow. I'd walk by the women's meditation hall. And the women's meditation hall would have 500 women in there. They'd be meditating while we were going to breakfast. And because it was Burma, these big halls, be air-conditioned, they had two sides, the two long sides of the building, were just a whole series of open doors. It's a very big arch door, so you can kind of see right in through the women's meditation hall. And sitting there, row after row, very straight rows, were 500 women meditating. And it was a powerhouse. It was one of the great sights of my life, is to see every morning these women meditating. And because there was this tremendous power of stillness and poverty of dignity and concentration in the way they were bearing themselves and engaged in what they were doing. They were engaged in something very dignified, very serious, very engaging, and something very still, very intent. And I was very inspired by both the intentness, the dignity, and the sense of concentrated power, powerful concentration that emanated from that phenomenally still room. There's a story in the suttas, the discourses of the Buddha, of a king who decides to go visit the Buddha. And the king was a little bit afraid, I think, of his life. He wasn't necessarily really a good guy. He had enemies. And he came to visit the Buddha, and the Buddha was staying in a grove someplace. And he had to kind of travel to get there. And in a respectful way, he got off his elephants and outside the grove. And then he walked in by foot into the grove. And when he got kind of into close to the middle of the grove, he got really nervous. I think the sutta says that his hair stood on end. Because he'd been told that there was a large group of monks and nuns together with the Buddha, in entourage, maybe 500 people in this grove with the Buddha. And he got spooked because there was no sound. It was the forest was completely still and tranquil. And he thought, oh, it's an ambush, And in fact, it was 500 people, the story goes, who were meditating. And the meditative stillness, was so palpable for him that it spooked him. As a kind of introductory kind of idea of concentration, I think of concentration as a kind of a clarity, a focus and a peace, clear, focused, peaceful thing. That reminds me, sometimes it's likened to clear water. But I think of it as likened to clear, clear air. I live up in the mountains up there, and sometimes when I come down the hill, I look and see what the air quality is like. And sometimes it's phenomenally clear to look across the bay and you see the hills there. And sometimes I can't even see down to the bottom of the hill to the town below here, because of the haze or the smog or whatever it might be. But there are times when it's really clear. And after a rain or something like that, there's stillness and crispness to the air. Great clarity. And the thing about that kind of clarity and stillness, it's very easy to miss it, to lose track of it. Because we tend to focus on the things of the world. We look at the billboards as we're driving, or at the houses, or we're listening to the radio, or listening to our minds, or we're focused and obsessed by something. And it's not that often that we actually appreciate the clear stillness of the air when it's clear and still. So concentration is like that. It's a factor of the mind. It's a quality of the mind that we can learn to appreciate, and we can strengthen and develop. We can clarify the mind so the mind becomes clearer and clearer. And the mind becomes clearer and clearer, then is a useful mind that can be put to certain kinds of uses. And in the Buddhist path, concentration and clarity and stability of mind is not for its own purpose, but rather it's for the purpose of supporting insight meditation, mindfulness practice, and leading to liberation. So concentration is sometimes likened to an unflickering candle flame. Unflickering candle flame. It's a very ancient simile. And a candle flame is very dynamic. It's very bright, it's dynamic, it's active, it's hot. And you can flicker in the wind back and forth and be kind of unstable. Or if there's no wind at all, it just can be very straight and still, just kind of float, straight up. And I love that metaphor because of the combination of the stillness of an unflickering flame and the sense of something dynamic and vital and vitality in that flame at the same time. So concentration is like that. There's something agitated about it, very still, unflickering. The mind is very, very focused and stable. But it's also very alert and very vital, very dynamic in its own way. And that's a very important principle to keep in mind when you look at concentration, is that balance or that combination of being, in a sense, kind of unmoving or a sense kind of still, while being very dynamic at the same time. The alternative would be to have a very calm, stable, still mind, but a mind that's really dull and falling asleep. And seeing the difference between a mind which is very calm but dull and a mind which is calm but very alert, is very important for finding your way to a concentrated state, into samadhi. So the word, the Buddhist word for concentration, or the Buddhist word that's usually translated into English as concentration, is called samadhi. It's a well-known word. It's used in, it's a Sanskrit and Pali word both. It's used in Hinduism and yoga traditions and all over. And but as the word but samadhi itself has a broader meaning than our English word concentration. The English word concentration has the implication, I believe, of concentrating, of centering oneself on something, centering, having a focus which is centered on something, kind of a one-pointed focus. That's an important element of samadhi, but samadhi includes a lot of other factors besides one-pointedness. So much so that it's probably better to think of samadhi as a state than a particular mental function. It's a state that we enter into, or sometimes in the sutta it's described as a state we abide in, we live in. So it's something you enter into, or it's something that envelops you, or something that's broader than just one particular function of the mind. That's why, in order to enter samadhi, it's not just a matter of having a one-pointed focus, whether it's willful or any other way. It's a matter of accommodating, including, a gathering together, a lot of other factors, mental factors, psychological factors, together with the one-pointedness. Samadhi is a very key element in the traditional Buddhist notion of the path, the Buddhist path. And the most famous formulation of this, I believe, is what's called the three trainings. All of Buddhism can be subsumed under what's called the three trainings. The first training is a training in sila, in ethics, or integrity, virtue. The second training is a training in samadhi. And the third training is a training in insight, or wisdom. Sila, samadhi, panya. Virtue, concentration, and wisdom or insight. There's a book by Dalai Lama where he translates this in his book, kindness, clarity, and wisdom. Kindness, clarity, and insight. I think the book is called, and I like that. You know that he wants to translate samadhi as clarity. There's a lot of different practices for developing sila. There's a wide range of practices for developing samadhi. And there's a range of practices for developing insight. And there's a kind of big repertoire, big toolbox that the Buddhist tradition has. Classically, in the Theravada tradition, they say that there are 40 different meditation practices for developing samadhi. And different personality types will choose different kinds of samadhi practices that are most suited for them. And a good teacher, in the classic texts, they talk about a good teacher would kind of ascertain what kind of personality you are and then assign to you the meditation that's appropriate for you. And so the teacher studies how you walk and how you eat and how you talk and, you know, all the different, you know, whether you're a greed type or a hate type or a deluded type or a faith type or, you know, intellectual type or whatever. And then they would. I've very rarely known any teachers to do this. Most teachers have, you know, one practice fits all. But classically, that was kind of the idea. You'd work with person's character and disposition and choose something that works for them. But there's a lot of different forms of samadhi practices. Now, as I said, samadhi is not an end in itself, usually, but is a means to another end, and is the means to developing insight, support for the possibility of insight. It's a means to purification of all the kind of what accumulates in our system, in our psychophysical system, through a lifetime of reactivity. Reactivity, if it's strong enough or chronic enough, gets stored somewhere in the psychophysical being, and gets in the way of settling, deep, quiet, peace. And part of the function of concentration practice is help with that purification practice, somehow dislodge these things which are held in the system. It's also for the purposes of becoming more independent. Concentration practice helps the mind become more and more independent from the obsessions of the mind, the kind of things that the mind is so quick to cling to, hold on to, or obsess about, be afraid of, whatever it might be. And so it's the word, the Pali word is viveka, very important word. And viveka is usually translated into English as either detachment or seclusion or solitude. And I'll give a talk on that one Sunday or Monday next month or so. But I think it's better in English probably to translate it as independence, a sense of the mind becomes independent from the usual things that it's stuck in or caught by. And then concentration also is means towards liberation, becoming fully liberated. As Tanisara Bhikkhu likes to say, we develop our concentration, which belongs to the conditioned world, that part of the world that it's created and formed and manipulated and constructed. Because concentration, it belongs to that constructed world, something that comes together because of causes and conditions. And you bring it to the pinnacle of the possibility of the constructed world so that you can jump off that edge of the pinnacle into the unconstructed, the unconditioned, the unmade, the unformed. That which you can't create, but you have to get to the edge of that pinnacle, the edge of that diving board, in order to jump into the pool. Now the Buddha emphasized, or one way of reading the Buddhist teachings, there's a strong emphasis that the mind can be changed, the mind, the heart, that the mind is malleable. And the mind is not a thing. The mind is an activity, or a composite of many different activities. And because it's an activity, it's very susceptible to be changed and affected by all kinds of conditions around it. And if you're not taking some responsibility for how your mind is being shaped, then your mind can be shaped by the circumstances you find yourself in. It certainly can be shaped by the experiences you have growing up and your family environment, but it's also going to continue to be shaped by what influences it in the present moment. And some people lock into a certain kind of mindset and don't allow for any possible change. But that becomes very brittle and very painful after a while if you kind of hold it tight in one way. And if you're more open and fluid with the environment, but you're not taking some responsibility for how the mind changes, then advertisers on the media will have their say on you, or popular fashions and popular culture and all your friends and all your enemies and, you know, your colleagues, and all these forces in society will actually shift and change your mind in ways that are sometimes very gross and very subtle. I mean, a very simple example, which is not very noble in my mind, was that I noticed that after I moved to this area in the early 90s, I was going to school at Stanford, and our sitting group met in Palo Alto. And before that, I'd lived in Berkeley, and I'd been a student, and lived in Asia, and all kinds of places. And I'd never been in a community that had so many new cars. And I noticed that in my thought about what kind of car I should be driving was being kind of moving in the direction of thinking I should have a new car. I know that if I'd stayed in San Francisco where I was living, it probably wouldn't have occurred to me. But somehow I was being shaped by the local kind of culture. My mind was being changed by that. So the mind is malleable, and if you don't take some responsibility for what shapes the activity of the mind, then other things will. So part of what we're doing in Buddhism is beginning to take responsibility for what shapes the mind. Now this is a very important teaching, because I believe, and I could be wrong here, maybe it doesn't apply to many of you, but I believe there's a very strong emphasis in Western American Buddhism to be focusing on having an experience. There's a really good experience. You want a good meditative experience. And you're focusing on a certain kind of, you know, bliss or joy or concentration or something. But traditionally, the teachings of the Buddha were not very experience-directed. That wasn't that important. And there's a lot more to be said about that. And so, but what is important is how you shape your mind. That's really important. You take this malleable capacity of the mind and this activity, which we call the mind, and begin reorganizing it so that it becomes more useful, develop a kind of skill set of the mind so that the mind can be used for further purposes along the path. So there is no word in Pali for meditation. We think of Buddhism as a meditative tradition, but there is actually no real word. It's hard to kind of find something that's equivalent to the word meditation. The word that's most commonly used in Pali is bhavana. And bhavana means cultivation or development. That the Buddhist practice is a practice of cultivating something or developing something. And as opposed to, you know, whatever we think meditation might be. And what that means is that bhavana, the practices of cultivation, include much more than just meditation. The word bhavana is much broader. Includes practices in ethics and generosity, and it includes, you know, how you, your livelihood, how you live your life, and, you know, how you the kind of speech you cultivate. Many, many things. So samadhi is much broader than our English notion of one-pointedness. It's a state of being, a state of mind, and includes many mental factors, and one-pointedness is just one of them. And so we can look at some of the other factors that come into play when we enter into samadhi. That's one of the things we'll do in the course of this class. The Buddhist tradition distinguishes between right samadhi and wrong samadhi. One of the factors of the Eightfold Path is right samadhi. So it distinguishes between right and wrong samadhi. And it's possible to get into a concentrated state and it be the wrong concentrated state. It's a concentrated state which is not useful for being on the path. If you, if you want to go out and rob banks, I suspect that, you know, you case the bank and midnight you decide to go down to the local bank and you do your job. You might be really concentrated. But that concentration comes together with greed and other factors. A soldier might be really concentrated. A boxer might be really concentrated. But that concentration comes together with other factors. And so those factors are unwholesome factors that actually maybe are fueling that wrong concentration, that unskillful concentration. When concentration, when one-pointedness is joined together with obsessive thinking, obsessive preoccupation, with greed or hate, then it's considered to be wrong concentration, unuseful concentration. Right concentration has the absence of obsessiveness of any kind. Right samadhi includes a purity of mind and heart. Remember, in the three trainings, the training in virtue comes first. It's the foundation for concentration. Right concentration includes a sense of purity, mental purity or virtue. It includes, there's a kind of a purity of mind, sincerity of mind. It also includes a stilling of the mind. The stilling of the mind is a very important part of concentration, of samadhi. And the different levels of samadhi involve progressive stilling of the different factors and activities of the mind. It's like the mind is actually made up of many activities. You can think of the mind as being an intertwined cord, of intertwined rope of many different cords. I don't know what the right word is, but and as the concentration gets deeper, some of the strands that make up the rope fall away. Or as the mind gets more and more concentrated, some of these different activities of the mind fall away and become quieter, get stilled, become quiescent. And part of the great peace and joy of a concentrated state comes from this great sense of stillness. And so the analogies that are often used, you probably know, is a really quiet lake that completely still and reflects the mountains in the distance. Right samadhi is not forced. It's possible to use our willpower or force to get into a concentrated state. And for the most part, and this is not completely accurate, but for the most part, right samadhi doesn't arise as an act of force. It has a lot to do with a sense of allowing for a possibility. There's in my understanding of the cultivation of samadhi, one of the factors that needs to be there is a sense of allowing for some kind of possibility of unification, of collectedness, of all these different factors that need to be collected in order to enter the samadhi state. So I don't think of it as something that can be forced. So it is a collectedness, and some people actually will talk about samadhi as being a unification of the mind and body. That what's involved in the concentrated state is the mind-body get unified. And as I often teach, maybe in my other intro class, if your mind and body are in two different places, you're not really doing the practice. Meaning that your body's never going to go anywhere but here. But if your mind is thinking about what happened at work earlier today, a conversation you had yesterday, or is thinking about your plans for next week, then your mind is somewhere else than where your body is. And so there's a fragmentation going on, kind of split between the body and mind of sorts. And what we're trying to do is to heal all the different fragmentations of our psychophysical being in order to enter into the samadhi. So samadhi requires an integrity, it requires an integration, at least temporarily, of all the activities of our being. So sometimes called a collectedness, everything gets collected together, an integration. Now, fragmentation seems to be a very strong quality of our modern society. And I believe there's a lot of different forces in our kind of popular American society which supports fragmentation, supports a psyche being fragmented and not really settling and being stable and being able to track one thing for any length of time. I think that the way the media has gotten faster and faster, occasionally we'll rent a video and we would rent it, like sometimes we rent an old video. Like last week I finally saw Gone with the Wind, which I'd never seen. And that movie was like 3 hours and 40 minutes. And if it made in modern kind of modern style, you could have had all the scenes that it had. None of the words could have been shortened. None of the conversation shortened, but the whole thing would have been done in an hour and a half, because there was all the spaciousness in the movie, as time and music and scenery, and you know, it's really slow. And a lot of the older movies had the slowness to them that people don't have patience for anymore. Let's get on with it. We're multitasking and. You know, you give too much space in the movie for just the scenery by itself, and people will bring out their Palm Pilots to check their email. And the pace of MTV kind of movie, and just the pace in which movies go on, and the pace of the news media. You know, its news media has a lot of short clips. It doesn't have any often very I watch regular kind of evening news. It doesn't have it doesn't really help you become concentrated and focused and stable on some topic. You know, you've a couple of minutes at the most, that's a lot, and you're on to the next thing, you know, and the mind, you know, is always kept jumping and going. But it isn't just simply that our society which doesn't support a stable, concentrated mind. The mind itself doesn't support it. There are internal factors. The mind will sometimes rebel against developing concentration. Partly because concentration does involve a stilling of the mind, and the mind doesn't want to be stilled, even though there's a lot of benefits to stilling the mind. It's ultimately a lot more pleasurable than the alternative. It's a lot more creative and intelligent than the alternative. It's often a lot less energy is expended than the alternative when the mind is fragmented. But there's a tendency for us to be somehow addicted to our thoughts. And the mind is kind of short-term directed, wanting short-term happiness. And short-term happiness often is understood to be, I just want to be free. I don't want to control the mind. Any kind of control is a limitation on the pleasure or the joy or the freedom of the mind. And it doesn't want to be controlled. It wants to be free, to kind of be fragmented, go off in all kinds of directions. And when the mind is fragmented and goes in all kinds of directions, it doesn't settle. And it can seem very important to chase after 10,000 thoughts. Our thoughts seem very important to us. But in fact, the mind which is collected, the mind which is controlled, in the way that samadhi involves a controlled, collected mind, is actually much more satisfying than the scattered, distracted mind. But the mind doesn't know that. You might know that intellectually, but the mind doesn't know that. It's like an unruly kid who doesn't know anything and needs to be, or a wild horse who needs to be trained. And so you have to know that about the mind, that the mind will rebel often to getting concentrated. It sometimes, you know, if for the untrained mind, it doesn't understand the tremendous benefits from being concentrated. And it doesn't see, why should I go there? What's the purpose? But the uncontrolled mind doesn't relax, or very rarely relaxes. So if you want to have very deep relaxation, you need to have a mind which is able to control in some way or other. And the deepest forms of relaxation that can come through meditation come with having a great skill in how to control the mind. Even if you can get, you know, very somewhat relaxed by listening to music or laying by the ocean, listening to the waves, or getting a good massage, it doesn't compare at all to what's possible through very deep meditation. I'm still surprised, kind of amazed at this little thing. I've known it for 20 years. That I'm more relaxed after my morning meditation than I was when I woke up from sleep. If sleep isn't even as relaxing as meditation. Of what a controlled mind can do. Part of a very important aspect of developing samadhi or concentration is our capacity to let go. And probably, you know, one of the more important factors that support concentrated state is our ability to learn to let go. In letting go, you can let go out of faith. The teacher tells you to let go and you do. Or you can let go out of wisdom because you know the things you're holding on to are not worth holding on to. But somehow or other, beginning to let go of the need to think about things. Joseph Goldstein used to like to say, in meditation, nothing whatsoever is worth thinking about. And I used to say that a lot until someone came up to me after a teaching and said to me, oh, you know, I used to be part of a cult and they used to teach us that. So then I better not say that. But for the most part, 99.999% of the time, there's nothing whatsoever you really need to think about in an active kind of discursive street kind of way when you're meditating. There are times when you're developing meditation that you want to think actually, but the thinking is directly related to negotiating the path of meditation. So this integration with all the different activities of the mind are unified together on this for the same purpose. Even our thinking is unified for the same purpose. And there are times when our thinking is actually useful. But I think Joseph's teaching is very few of us get to that point where we let go of our thinking is to let go of all the stuff which has nothing to do with meditation at all. And then if it has to do with meditation, we have to let go of our judgments about measuring how we're doing. That's not on the path either. So it involves a kind of letting go. It also involves relaxing. And this principle of relaxation is a very important one for developing concentration. You need to be, as you're developing concentration, you need to be looking in your psychophysical being, in your body, your muscles, in your mind. Where is the tension? And can you begin relaxing that tension, letting go of that tension? The more you can be relaxed in meditation up to a point, the easier it will be to enter into a concentrated state, a calm, concentrated state. If you don't, some people will try to get concentrated, but they're tense in doing that. And that then goes against what the very thing they're trying to do. It goes counter what they're doing. And some people actually get more and more tense the more they practice. And sometimes that tension can give rise to a kind of wrong samadhi, kind of an unuseful concentration. And the paradox that often happens is that people will push and get really tense and strive and try to get concentrated. And then at some point, for some reason or other, they give up their efforts. They give up the tension of striving. But that's set up the condition of that they've done a fairly good job, but finally when they do relax and let go of the striving, then they drop down to a whole different level of concentration. But it's not their doing. It's kind of like they just let go into it. The development of concentration, of samadhi, requires a lot of respect and a lot of care. And for those of you who have a tendency towards faith, it takes a lot of veneration, a lot of faith, but a lot of respect and a lot of care to enter into the practice of concentration with respect. Respect for the practice itself, but also a lot of respect for yourself and for your mind, and respect for what it takes to do the practice. It's kind of like if you go into the forest. Say you're going to go spend a week in the forest, go backpacking someplace up in Alaska where there's wild bears or whatever. And you need to go in with some kind of respect to the forest. You'd be with care. You prepare yourself. You learn about a little bit about the local circumstances. You go in, and you're respectful of the forest as you go in, which means, in part, you're attentive and alert to what's there. You're not casual or callous to what's there. But there's a kind of respect or care or a kind of that supports that intentness, that involvement. So when you sit down to practice concentration, I think it's a lot easier if you do it by first establishing a sense of respect for what you're doing, and going to the practice of concentration in a respectful way. Like you go to Asia, for example, and you travel all the way to Asia to see some great, wonderful, enlightened master, and you're finally able to get to her temple, and there she is, and you kind of enter kind of respectfully and with care and veneration or faith. And even if you were kind of a flaming atheist, mm-hmm. It's kind of, most people would, have some care as they go in a situation like that. So respect, care. Part of respect is you go prepare. You prepare yourself for such a thing. So I think a very important part of developing samadhi is the preparation you do before you actually start the practices of concentration. And that goes maybe against the grain of what some people would like. They would like concentration, and they'd like just to be told what to do, A, B, C, sit down, there you do it. But actually, you want to set up a context, an environment, an ecology of the mind and the heart that becomes supportive for concentration to arise. And that is, to a great part, is my understanding of samadhi. You have a lot of responsibility for the arising of samadhi. But your responsibility is to laying the optimal conditions for it to arise by itself. Samadhi is not something you make happen so much, for the most part, unless you're quite an adept. But for the most part, it's something that, even if you are adept at doing it, it's something like you figure out how optimally to create the conditions so that this thing, this mysterious thing, envelops you or rises within you or settles through you or locks in within you, or this groove that you've kind of settled into and you're on the groove or whatever it might be. So that's why the idea of preparation is very important. Preparing yourself and understanding what are the various causes and conditions that I can put into place to support the possibility of something arising. It's like this movie that you've seen, maybe some of you have seen, called Field of Dreams. And the mantra there is, build it and he will come. And it's like that. You have to build it. You have to build your meditation. And then something will come. But you don't know what it is until it arises. So it requires preparation. And that preparation can be your whole life. If you're really serious, in a certain way, you can kind of rearrange and organize your whole life and be concerned about your actions throughout the day, your speech throughout the day, your livelihood throughout the day, your ethics throughout the day. You can be concerned about the various factors of how you live your life in such a way that you notice which way to live your life creates more agitation in the mind, and which ways of living tend to create more calm, more concentration. So I can imagine, if you're really serious about developing a concentrated mind, and you sit very diligently, and you sit and meditate in the morning for 45 minutes, and then you go to San Pablo where they have the casino and spend the whole day kind of, doing the one-armed bandits and, all the lights and the flashing and the sounds, and you just, whatever concentration or whatever you built up during that 45 minutes, it's just blown away through that activity. You need to have, the rest of your life can be supportive of developing concentration. Some people will take this very seriously and look in how can they reorganize their lives in some way or other to make that happen. So other people don't want to do that or don't need to because their lives are pretty sane to begin with. One of the classic preparations for samadhi, or ways of supporting it to arise, is a practice called guarding the sense doors, which means not letting a lot of different sense input come into you in an uncontrolled fashion. Letting there be taking some care about the sense input in your psyche. Because the more sense input you get, the more, faster it can be, sometimes will agitate the mind and make it more hard for it to settle and get concentrated. It's said that moderation in food and drink is helpful as preparing to enter into samadhi or develop concentration. So you want to be careful with your diet. Not to be an ascetic by any means, but not too much, not too little. With your sleep, sleeping too much disturbs the possibilities of concentration. Sleeping too little can do that also. It helps if you can cultivate a sense of contentment. Contentment is considered one of the precursors of concentration. So, it means using your intelligence and looking at your life, looking at the places of discontent. And can you cultivate contentment, a greater sense of contentment in your life? It seems a little bit odd for me to say that, because a lot of people want to meditate so they can feel more content. And I'm telling you, don't meditate until you're more content. But the two can go together. It can be very helpful if you're very clear about the purpose of your meditation. So there's kind of intentness or sense of purposefulness about what you're doing. So you really know what you're doing. You have a good sense of why you're doing this. What's the purpose of developing concentration? What's the purpose of meditation? So when you sit down, there's some clarity of purpose that informs what you're doing. That clarity of purpose, then you're less likely to be filled with doubt and wondering what to do. And, yesterday I counted my breath. Today I think I'll note my breath. Today maybe a bit better day to listen to sounds. And maybe today I should just take a bath. And so the mind can be very confused. But if you have a real sense of purpose, it's a lot easier for the mind to get settled and kind of get on the program. So thinking about your sense of purpose, your intention, is an important part of all this. And spending some time outside of meditation clarifying this by yourself or with friends or with a teacher can be very helpful for the purposes of developing concentration. And then a little bit more directly connected to meditation itself, having a clean and quiet environment is considered very helpful for concentration. So you can understand that as you wish, but maybe making sure that your place where you meditate, at your home or whatever, feels clean and orderly. And making, so you sit down, you enter into an orderly world or a clean world, a place that feels calm. If you have a lot of things, messy all over, the room doesn't feel calm. So you create a calm, clean environment. Some people will take it to the point of always bathing before they develop concentration. Always have their body is clean. And I've heard of even people put on clean clothes. So there's a whole sense of cleanliness and kind of purity, perhaps, that's supportive of this developing concentration. I often feel different when I put on really clean clothes, I feel kind of cleaner myself, and it's easier to feel content and settled and concentrated. So I said earlier that the important part of samadhi is letting go. In fact, samadhi involves two important factors, many factors, but right now, two important factors that work together in combination. There has to be some feeling of, some aspect of letting go, of relaxing and letting go. But it has to be together with making effort, being engaged, endeavoring. And if all you do is practice letting go, you might enter into a kind of concentrated state, but then you have to put a lot of effort into doing it well. So the effort has to be there that way. You can really make effort to letting go. But the tendency is if you only practice letting go, it tends to make the mind dull and drowsy. And so you need to bring the effort factor to match that. People put in too much effort and don't have enough relaxation and letting go, the mind doesn't really become still and quiet. It actually stays more agitated and active or energized, agitated. And both these things, letting go and applying ourselves in the practice, making effort and applying ourselves, involves using our ability to choose. to choose what we do with our mind. Without seeing the point of choice, where you have a choice, and then choosing to follow your purpose to get concentrated, there is no path. So it involves a choice. And that choice, that seeing the place of choice, becomes more and more refined the more you do the practice. But for example, just a choice to sit down and meditate is a choice you make. You see the possibility of meditating, and you make that choice. You sit down to meditate, and you see the choice of turning the mind towards the breath. And so you make that, you apply yourself there. You see the choice of letting go of thinking about tomorrow. So you make that choice to let go of it. You notice the mind has drifted off and thinking about something. There's a choice, and you notice that, that's a moment of choice. What do you do then? You could judge yourself and criticize yourself. It might not feel like a choice to do that. It might be automatic. Or there's a choice, you just very matter-of-factly come back and begin again with the breath. To re-engage yourself, reapply yourself to the purpose that you set yourself to do. So a lot of meditation involves exercising your capacities for choice. But it's doing it together with a sense of relaxation and letting go. So that sense of choice doesn't become a burden. It actually becomes part of the beauty of what an alert, clear, peaceful mind is about. It doesn't feel like a burden at all, but actually something really delightful to do, to exercise this choice. At first, as you're developing concentration, there's a lot of applied effort that's required. We apply ourselves and apply ourselves. We kind of give the effort to the situation. We choose to apply ourselves. We choose over and over again. At some point, you kind of get into the rhythm, or the mind settles into kind of the concentration. And then it becomes less and less applied effort, but more kind of self-generating effort. It's not you generating it, but sometimes generated by the system. And in a sense, maybe all you have to do is kind of like keep it pointed in the right direction. And your choice just involves keeping the energy pointed in the right direction, as opposed to keep choosing to reapply and reapply, because the energy is beginning to kind of roll on its own. So there's no samadhi without relaxation. But relaxation gone too far puts us to sleep or leads to complacency. And complacency is one of the great hindrances to a long-term meditation. Many meditators sooner or later become complacent in their meditation. They get kind of a warm, fuzzy, nice feeling. And they kind of become just, oh, it's okay, you know. All their major conflicts and concerns have kind of dealt with. And they're kind of not suffering so much, and things are comfortable. And just nice to kind of settle back into this comfortable place. So one of the things this points to, in that meditation or concentration involves a balance of alertness, of applied effort, of using our choice and letting go and relaxing, it also involves using our intelligence. And I think that in my encounter with a good number of meditators, there's a kind of feeling that intelligence isn't necessarily, shouldn't be part of the practice. Something wrong with intelligence, or you know, you shouldn't be. But using our intelligence is a very important part of meditation practice. Everybody has enough intelligence. So it isn't like, you know, you don't have enough intelligence, you know, that person's smarter than me. I don't know if this is really true, what I'm about to say, but I like to think it's true. That it's your intelligence which gets you into suffering. And so all the intelligence you need to get you into suffering is all the intelligence you need to get you out of it. So if you're not a very intelligent person, then there's not a lot of intelligence that goes into your suffering. And so you don't need a lot of intelligence to do the practice. If you're really intelligent, a lot of intelligence has gone into your suffering. So don't take this as a law or a rule. But you know, everybody has enough intelligence, but it does involve using the intelligence you have. Being alert, clear, thinking sometimes about it, following your way. It's kind of like if you're in that woods, kind of walking along, and you suddenly need to cross, you know, some terrible rapids, and there's a very narrow kind of log that goes across, and you really intend to cross that log, you have to be very concentrated, but you want to use all your intelligence to figure out how to get across. You notice a vine there, you notice this and that, slippery rock there, and you're engaged. And by the time you get across the other side, your mind might be very still. But it wasn't stillness that, you know, that avoided a lack of intelligence. Are you all following me? Is this going okay tonight?
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking much longer than I thought I would. But that's the way it is. And so in terms of the preparation, preparing ourselves for practicing concentration, you might look at your life and look at what makes sense to do. The other thing you might do is think, there's actually a preparation you do for each particular meditation session. And you can call this like a setting up for meditation. And each person, I recommend each of you to find a way of setting up your meditation. So you're not just simply just going into your room and plopping down and beginning to meditate, but you give yourself some period of time, a couple of minutes, 5 minutes or something, to set up the meditation, to prepare yourself for it. And each of you will have your own way of doing that, your own procedures, your own ritual. Some people like to do it very ritualistically, some people other ways. It might mean spending a couple of minutes unwinding, maybe going for a little walk first, or just sitting looking out the window for a while before you go meditate, doing something which is kind of relaxing. So you're not depending on your meditation to relax you, but you do kind of the obvious ways first. Some people like to chant. Some people like to recite the Metta Sutta. Some people like to do some loving-kindness meditation as a preparation for meditation. Some people will sit down in front of an altar with a Buddha figure or something that's sacred. So there's a feeling of being connected to some sacredness. Some people like to read some inspirational literature before they meditate. So there's a sense of faith and enthusiasm and confidence maybe as they're going to do the practice. Part of preparing it is to sit down consciously and respectfully. Part of that, what that involves, is being careful and respectful for the posture that you take for your meditation practice. The posture that you sit in has a lot to do with how easy or difficult it is to get concentrated. So be careful with your posture. Develop a good, balanced, alert posture. A good posture is something that gets developed over time. It's not like a done deal. Just, you know, you sit down, you have either good or bad posture, helpful or not helpful posture. But you actually begin cultivating. It might take a few months. But first might be a little bit uncomfortable even. But you take and seem to develop a posture which is supportive of being stable, rooted, concentrated, alert. It's the classic kind of metaphor for a good meditation posture is to sit like a mountain. Either physically, like a triangle, or kind of just have a sense of being rooted like a mountain, stable and upright. Then, once you actually, you know, do all that, then you actually start sitting. In the sitting itself, do some little setup. And when I do my intro class, I almost do the same thing every time, right? Kind of how I guide people. That's one way of doing it. For this class, I'll do something different, guiding you into the concentration. But you'll find your own way of how you do it. For this class, what I recommend you experiment with, unless you have your own way, is what I call the 7-point breathing, or 7 steps of breathing, which is you take 7 breaths, and for each breath, as you exhale, the inhalation, you feel a certain part of your body. In the exhalation, you exhale. And you count those 7 breaths backwards. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So the first, number 7, is your scalp in the back of your head, top of your head. Breathe in, feel that part, and then relax that part of your body. 7. Then your face. Breathe in, feel your face. As you exhale, Relax your face. There's a lot of tension we hold in our face. 6. Breathe in. Feel the area of your neck and your shoulders. As you exhale, relax. Soften that part of your body. 5. Breathe in and feel the area of your chest and your back rib cage. As you exhale, relax that part of your body. And then the area of your diaphragm, your solar plexus. And then your whole abdominal cavity area. And then your legs and your feet. So you kind of do those 7 steps. And that's one way, like for some people, it can be a very powerful way of kind of relaxing the surface tension of the day. Reminding themselves, what you're going to do now is to be collected and unified for some purpose to really be here and now with what you're going to apply yourself to. And then you want to be intent. Intentness is a very important part of the intelligent engagement with meditation practice. And learning how to be intent in such a way that supports relaxation is part of the art that we're looking at here. So before we do a meditation, I give you actually some instructions that you might want to you can try. As important as it is setting yourself up for meditation beforehand, is how you emerge out of meditation. And some people, you know, their whatever signal they get that the meditation's over, and the bell rings, and they pop up and think about their coffee or whatever they think about, and off they go. But that's actually kind of disrespectful of what you just went through. What you want to do is spend a couple of minutes, it doesn't have to be a long time, reviewing that meditation, what that was like. Part of the art is to learn how to do that in a non-judgmental way. But just kind of matter-of-factly review, what was that like? What happened during that meditation? How present were you? How sleepy were you? How alert were you? How tense were you? If you're following the breath, how many breaths could you follow? What were the main things that got in the way of being concentrated? How did this meditation compare to the meditation yesterday or last week, or the pattern of your meditations over the last while? And that kind of comparison as part of the review is not meant to judge, but and not supposed to be helping you kind of figure out, are you making progress in some kind of neurotic way? But just kind of beginning to get a sense of what's working, how things work, what are the patterns? How did you engage yourself? What happened when you engaged yourself? How did you work with different things? How might you do better next time you sit down? Oh, I was kind of complacent that sitting. Oh, you know, last few days of sittings, I keep thinking about motorcycles. And what a great it would be to have a Harley. You know, and so you notice that. It's been going on for a few times now. I think next time when I sit down, I think I'm going to be more diligent and really try to cut off those Harley thoughts earlier. You know, and but that reviewing helps you kind of sort through all these things. Also, and maybe even more important, part of the function of reviewing is that, in a sense, you know that you're accountable for that meditation, that you're interested in it. And so while you're meditating, there's a certain kind of more greater interest in understanding what's going on. You want to understand your meditation. You want to understand what's going on. You want to track it to some degree. That engagement, that tracking, is one of the things that then cultivates concentration. Am I making sense? Okay. So I do apologize for talking so much, because maybe it's a lot of material to take in. And I did earlier today when I was preparing for this, I did think this should have been a 2-hour class. But this is the way. Next time. So I'd like just to sit a little bit. And what I'd like to do is for you all to stand for a minute and stretch your legs. And the thing about talking too much, We can call it the Tibetan style. Tibetan teachers, when you go on retreats, what they do is they just teach, because it's so rare to get teachings. And then you're just expected to put it on in practice when you get home. Why would you waste time with a teacher putting it in practice? Because you're better off learning. So, you know, not that I'm comparable, but that's the how we justify today. So I'm planning, because it's already almost 9:15, we're supposed to stop at 9, right? That's what we said in the advertisement. I would like to go a little bit longer through the class, maybe to 10 after. If that's a problem with anyone, then you can get up and leave, or you might, or if you're comfortable doing this right now, is to go sit kind of near the side there, so it's easier for you to get up and leave and not disturb people. But it won't be longer than that. So take a comfortable, alert posture. Gently close your eyes. And take a few moments to reflect on this idea that it really takes some sense of respect to engage in meditation practice. Hopefully a joyful respect, a willing respect, but some sense of care, respect. It can be helpful to take 2 or 3 long, slow, deep breaths. And as you exhale, relax your body, your mind. And then experiment now with a 7-point breathing. And as you do it, it's fine to breathe a little bit more deeply than you naturally would, just to kind of get into it. So you begin with your top of your head, your scalp, the back of your head, breathing in and letting go. Your face, neck and shoulders, chest and back rib cage, the diaphragm and solar plexus, the belly, the abdomen and the waist and lower back. Let everything sink, let everything surrender everything to gravity. And then also your legs, feet. And then take a few moments now to feel your whole body, a global sense of your body, whatever that means for you. And within the body, as part of the body, become aware of your breathing. Kind of a global sense of your breathing. It's global as is easy to do. In order to develop concentration, we want to switch our mind's activity from thinking predominantly to sensing. It's a practice of sensing more than of thinking. So we want to sense the felt sense, the feeling of what it feels like for the body to be breathing. The sensations of expansion and contraction, pressure and release of pressure. And feeling kind of the global sense of the body. Perhaps you can feel the breathing is kind of like a massage. Expanding and contracting, moving your body. Hang in there with that sense of movement and expansion, contraction. And if it's enjoyable, by all means enjoy it. If you're comfortable with a global sense of the body breathing, stay with that. If you're more comfortable familiar with choosing a particular place to be aware of your breathing, the abdomen or the chest or the nostrils, then you can let your attention focus on that particular place. The first two mental factors that are cultivated with concentration, the first is connecting the attention to the objects of concentration. So connecting now to the breathing, turning the attention and feeling, sensing the breath. The second factor is the ability of the mind to hold that breathing in attention over time, sustaining the attention. And there are two different factors. The first one is strengthened by whenever you need to, choosing to come back to the breath and reconnecting. The second factor involves, once you're connected, then doing what it takes to hang in there with the breathing over time. Hang in there with the rhythm of breathing in and out. And then in order to support staying connected with each breath, begin counting your breath. And the way to count is to count each exhalation. And count up to 10. Each exhalation gets a count. And make sure you count each one. If you lose count, very matter-of-factly, begin again at 1. Count in a relaxed fashion, but be somewhat intent enough so that you can stay there with the counting. You don't have to like counting. All you have to do is to count. Let go of anything which is extraneous to being concentrated on the breath. Whatever else the mind gets involved in, it's normal for the mind to do that. So you don't have to be upset. Just when you notice the mind is involved with something else, reconnect to the breath, and then remember to sustain the attention with the breathing over time, letting the counting support you to maintain it over time. And it's not simply a matter of trying to maintain the concentration over time, the continuity of attention, but it's also a matter of being interested in doing that, being interested in discovering what happens when you do that. What happens when you're not successful? What happens when you are? Being interested in reapplying yourself and trying again, and maybe trying with a little different kind of effort, more application or more relaxation. Don't be afraid of interest, curiosity, investigation of how can you do this? What does it take? Experiment. And then in the last minute or two of the sitting, now very matter-of-factly, review what that was like. What was the quality of your efforting like? Were you trying too hard? Were you trying not enough? How could you have done better? So there are, as I said, many different ways of developing concentration, many different concentration practices. The one that I'm offering as the foundation for this class, at least, is mindfulness of breathing. And for the beginning of the class, I'd like to encourage you to count your breaths, 1 to 10, and begin again over again. 1 to 10, 1 to 10, just keeping it up. If you lose track, start over again. The counting has a lot of functions. Certainly keeps us on the track because you have to be alert enough to remember to count. If you're agitated and distracted, then the counting kind of tends to kind of hold the mind stiller and keep you more on track and kind of brings a balance from that direction, brings you more to a center. If you're sleepy or dull or kind of not very energetic or engaged, then you have to arouse enough effort in order to maintain the count. In order to count, you have to have more energy. You have to have some energy to count. So if you're too sleepy, then the whatever it takes to be able to remember to count, it requires you to kind of rev up in a sense. So it tends to bring more balance from that direction. So if you're imbalanced and either too agitated or too dull, the counting can be very helpful. You want to count in such a way that the counting actually feels helpful in terms of the inner voice that does the counting. Maybe you need to soften it. Sometimes you need to make it louder, clear, more precise, sometimes more directed. So okay, you experiment a little bit with how you count. One way of experimenting is, in order to keep it kind of fresh and not becoming mechanical, is you can vary when you, in the cycle of the breath, you count. Meaning that you might first count at the end of each exhalation. And then some other time when you feel that gets more mechanical, you just switch to the beginning of the exhalation. Because, you know, you have to be a little bit on your toes then. And then you might do it in the middle, right in the middle. Or then you might do it to the inhalation, count those. So you vary it if you feel like you need to kind of, if it's helpful to keep you on track so that you're not you're getting mechanical or automatic about how you're doing it, kind of out of habit. Counting, if you've never done it, is a very good way of finding out how concentrated you really are. I do it sometimes, and I'm surprised still to this day. Sometimes I think I'm much more concentrated than I am. You know, I think I'm doing just fine, you know, and then I count and I can get to 6, you know, or 5, or 2. So, oh, I guess I'm not as concentrated as I thought I was. And there's a way in which the calm mind sometimes can fool itself into thinking you're much more engaged than you actually are. And the counting is a kind of truth teller, kind of tells you what's really going on. So it has a lot of functions. And for the first week, I'd like to encourage you just to use the counting to learn what it takes to be able to hold the breath in your awareness over the time of the meditation practice. It's a training in what it's like to hold your attention or hold something in awareness. Don't worry too much about how calm you get or how concentrated you get in some other kind of definition of concentration. Just experiment and massage and investigate. What does it take to hold something in attention over time? And what does it take to kind of hold, let more and more of your psyche kind of envelop itself or be enveloped by the breath? So that the integration, the gathering together of everything around the breath is what's going on. I would like those of you who come to this class, the kind of requirement, I think it was posted in the newsletter, that for the, to sit 45 minutes every day. Because my understanding is you came to this class because you want to develop concentration, not to learn theory of concentration. And what's the point of coming to the class if you're not going to apply it? You might as well not come, right? And if you're going to apply it, you might as well apply it in a way that really kind of makes a difference. 45 minutes. So that's the expectation you come to this class. It doesn't have to be 45 minutes all in one sitting. Some of you might be new to all this. That's a challenge to sit for that long. It can be 2 sittings in the course of the day. It could be 3 15-minute sittings. Some people actually might sit much better in 15 minutes. But the quality is more important than the quantity. And some people can get a higher quality sometimes by sitting shorter times. I don't care how you do those 45 minutes, but it's 45 minutes each day. Okay? Gotta be. And the other thing I'd like you to do this week is I'd like you to memorize the Metta Sutta. And there's 2 reasons for that. One reason is that memorization is what gets cultivated in the mind when you memorize is what's needed for both mindfulness and concentration. And it's a very ancient practice in Buddhism to memorize things. It's very supportive. We don't do it so much in our modern culture in the way people did in the past. So it's just the concentration practice itself supports the meditation. But what I want you to do when you're memorizing the Metta Sutta is to study, investigate, be curious how you use your mind in order to memorize. How do you engage with this task of memorization? What does it take? What are the qualities of the mind? What is the focus of the mind? Relaxation of the mind? What kind of involvement does it take? What kind of, how do you hold something? Because you're holding it in awareness. You're holding something in your concentration if you're trying to memorize. I want you to study and learn that. Find out what it's like for you. So it's more than just a concentration exercise. It's an exercise in discovering something about your capacity of mind, how it works. Is that clear enough? And my hope is that part of that is that you'll then learn something about how you can engage, something helpful, but how you can also engage in your meditation that's comparable to something about how you engage in learning how to memorize. Mark?
If you've already met Martin, I'd like to see if you have a suggestion for something.
Which translation do you memorize? Okay. So you can either memorize the one we're giving you tonight, which is a different one, which kind of will be a new challenge, or you're welcome to memorize something different. You know, you could find, you know, look in the teachings of the Buddha book and find something you like in there. Also, some of you might find that by memorizing it, you can use that, you can chant it or recite it to yourself before you start sitting. And that engagement and that focus on the memorization, the 2, 3, 4 minutes it takes to say it, will really jumpstart your concentration when you sit down to be with your breathing. So Susan copied, how many did you make?
60.
It's probably not enough for everyone here, but some of you are here with friends or partners. Take one and share. And if you're going to be coming Saturday for the one-day sitting, or Friday for the one-day sitting, or Sunday morning for the... if you can just kind of wait a little bit and let the other people take first, and then if there's none left over, we'll have more... for you then. Is that okay? So that's the two requirements. It's the 45-minute sitting and the Metta Sutta. A suggestion, optional, for extra credit, is for you to maintain a journal during this time. At the end of each sitting, to actually write down your reviewing. Write down, kind of, so you have a, so you have some evidence, some track, some record of what happened and your engagement, your thoughts, your involvement with it. And then periodically over the 5 weeks, review that and see if you can learn from that journal. And we're not judging, you know, it shouldn't be a journal about how awful it was, or, you know, how terrible you were, or why you can't concentrate is because, you know, your boss got angry with you and, you know. So, you know, it's really kind of focusing on the actual, you know, technical aspects of what happened to you as you sat and how could you have done better and, just, you know, just in a very simple, straightforward way. The other thing I'll say is that 2 weeks from today, which I believe is the 15th of May, I'm going to come an hour early, so at 6:30. And those of you who would like to come and actually talk about what's going on with your meditation, would be kind of a group discussion, I think it's very helpful. And we're actually going to talk. You can talk a little bit about maybe bring your journals and read out of them, or, you know, or kind of just talk about what you're discovering and talk about the details, talk about what's difficult. And we'll do that separately from the class in 2 weeks. And hopefully that's going to serve some of you really well and be very interesting. And I'll end with there are three classic benefits to developing concentration practice or doing concentration practice. The first one is very beautiful. It says it helps you to have, it's for the purposes of dwelling happily and at ease in the present. Isn't that nice? The second is it cultivates insight and mindfulness. It supports and strengthens it. And the third is it's a condition for the cultivation of liberation. So those are three wonderful benefits. If you're not interested in liberation in the future, then you can just have a pleasant abiding in the present. Thank you.